Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, after the Uvalde school massacre, the public is demanding answers and solutions for guns. They're getting very little of each. And how green power is keeping the grid going in this Texas heat wave, but renewables are still getting a bad rap from the Republican leadership.
It does not make sense to poo-poo green energy because we're so good at it in Texas, and it's making a lot of money for us, and it's saving a lot of money for consumers. It is cleaning up the air. It is generating tax revenues for these rural counties. It is a good story for Texas, and we should celebrate it and be proud of it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Weeks after the school shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, there are still few answers about what happened that day. In fact, Texas officials have been telling the public contradictory information. So to get to the truth, frequently reporters can turn to public information, like 911 calls, police dispatch recordings, and body cameras. But in Texas, those records are tough or even sometimes impossible to obtain because the state is able to invoke something called the dead suspect loophole. As the director of the Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas, Kelly Shannon understands the state's public information law.
Thank you so much for coming.
At an open government seminar in San Antonio, people are focused on what's happening 60 miles away in Uvalde.
I think what we're seeing is an overall mood of non-transparency happening in Uvalde.
After the school shooting that left 21 dead, reporters have been trying to get answers. But Shannon says it appears Uvalde officials are working to keep the truth from coming out.
From the intimidation of the reporters that we're seeing there, to blocking photographers from being able to take pictures, to threatening to have secret meetings, maybe even having secret public meetings, we don't know.
Texas Public Radio and other news organizations filed open records requests for public documents related to the May 24th massacre. They were denied, citing numerous Texas Open Records Act exemptions, including one called the dead suspect loophole.
The policy consideration is a good one. Maybe you're wrongfully accused of something. You know, this was meant to protect the accused, and now it's been flipped on its head.
That's Texas State Representative Joe Moody, vice chair of the State House Committee investigating the Uvalde shooting. For years, he's worked to close the dead suspect loophole. He says law enforcement has taken advantage of it to hide information when a suspect dies in police custody. That's what happened to Graham Dyer.
My wife and I got the most dreaded phone call any parent can ever receive. Our son had been arrested by the Mesquite Police Department. Graham was very gravely injured.
Robert Dyer testified in 2019 to the Texas legislature about the night his son died in police custody. Graham had taken LSD and was having a bad reaction. He was picked up and charged with assaulting an officer. Then Mesquite PD refused to release the documents and videos to the Dyer family that would show what led to his death.
If somebody dies in police custody, I should think this is when we'd want to open all of our records.
That's not how the Texas Police Union sees it. The group objected to Moody's bill, and Governor Greg Abbott threatened to veto it. It never passed. The Dyer family eventually did get the information through a federal Freedom of Information request. That took over 2 years. This could offer a clue about what to expect with information from Uvalde. But Moody says his committee will be releasing a report about what went wrong at Robb Elementary.
That's the job of this committee, is to lay bare the facts, and that's what we intend to do.
Still, despite promises of openness, the committee is essentially operating in secret and not releasing who the witnesses are, their testimony, and even the specific goals of the investigation. Kelly Shannon says because of the lack of trust, the public deserves unfiltered information.
Transparency and openness is the key to healing and moving on, if it's even possible, from something like this.
Since the massacre in Uvalde, many have been calling on lawmakers to finally pass something that will make it more difficult for dangerous individuals to get and keep guns, particularly assault-style weapons like the AR-15-type semi-automatic. But in past years, it's been members of the Republican Party, those who receive big donations from the gun lobby, who have blocked these bills. Some are saying this time things are different, but that remains to be seen because right now these bills are stalled. San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro is pushing for a bill that would crack down on gun sales in a number of ways.
It essentially has to do with red flag laws and authorizing grant funding to help establish or maintain laws that allow for extreme risk protection orders at the state and local level.
So there is this compromise that we've heard about that Texas Senator John Cornyn has been taking the lead on. It's a framework to try and get a bipartisan buy-in to do something about gun violence. Is this instead of or additional to, or how does it work with this, with the proposal? Because there's a little talk of red flag laws, and can you talk about what that means and also in the Cornyn agreement?
Yeah, I mean, there's a pretty big difference between what the House of Representatives passed and what's being proposed in the Senate. In addition to the Federal Extreme Risk Protection Order Act, the House also passed the Protecting Our Kids Act. So it was not only legislation on red flag laws, but for example, lifting the age from 18 to 21 of purchasing a semi-automatic weapon, cracking down on straw purchases of firearms, strengthening safe storage requirements, outlawing bump stocks and high-capacity magazines, closing the ghost gun loophole. So all of these things that the House already passed last week, and really only a fraction of those are in the Senate proposal. And so far, we only have a framework. There isn't language in a bill that's been publicly put out yet. But don't get me wrong. Look, the Congress has been struggling for decades now to get really almost any kind of positive gun legislation, gun safety legislation. So something is better than nothing. And in the Senate framework, there are some good things that it does. For example, it closes the boyfriend loophole. It also gives incentives for states to adopt red flag laws. And so there's important pieces in there. And it also combats gun trafficking and straw purchasing. So there are positive aspects to it. I think the big difference is it doesn't do as much and it doesn't cover as many areas, but also a lot of what it does is incentivizes states to pass their own laws or adopt their own policies rather than require them. The exception to that is the part on closing the boyfriend loophole. Because right now you have convicted domestic abusers that can buy a gun if the domestic abuse they committed was not against a spouse. In other words, somebody that they were actually married to. And the other part, which is also important there, is that it's the first federal law against gun trafficking and straw purchasing. And if I analyze the Senate proposal, I'm asking myself as a policymaker, what is it requiring in the states and among the American people? And then what is it making optional to governors and states to do? Because the challenge we're going to have in Texas, in places like Texas and Florida and other states, is that you've got governors that are so beholden to the NRA, so beholden to the gun lobby, that they may be unlikely to do anything that's optional in the legislation that's passed.
Right. So when you keep saying they want to incentivize these red flag laws, so how much more incentive do you need than the fact that people who shouldn't have guns have guns? They have been shown to be at risk to themselves and others, and they are using them. Isn't that enough incentive to do something?
Well, no, I think people have the right to be frustrated and angry about the inaction at both the federal and the state levels of government, particularly in our home state of Texas. But my fear is that through this legislation, what will happen is that there's a pot of money out there for states as an incentive for states to adopt and strengthen red flag laws. And states like California, New York, and New Jersey and other places will take the money and maybe improve their own laws or tweak their own laws, and then states like Texas just won't take the money in the same way that they still haven't taken the money, billions of dollars, to expand Medicaid. And so we have the highest percentage of people in the country that don't have health insurance. That's my concern.
And that point ties into this talk that we've heard from Governor Greg Abbott that this is a mental health issue that would have been addressed more directly if we had expanded the health care in Texas.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, the governor helped cut a few hundred million dollars over the years from mental health funding. He has used part of the Health and Human Services budget of the state of Texas and dedicated that not to mental health, but to Operation Lone Star, which is patrolling the border, which has been a fiasco, just an embarrassment for the state, that program. Yeah, so here's a governor who says, well, the issue is a mental health issue, but he's cut mental health funding over the years. So yeah, he doesn't even believe in the things that he's saying is the solution. Doesn't believe that mental health funding is actually the solution because he's cutting it. And what you often see also in this debate is that one tactic of deflection is to put this issue or this problem in a silo and say, well, it's really just a mental health issue. Or sometimes when we see it in schools, it's an issue of bullying, for example. And it's a way to avoid talking about a fundamental problem, which is you have too many dangerous weapons in the hands of dangerous people. Over the years, it's just made it easier for dangerous people to get dangerous weapons in their hands.
Well, to that point about Greg Abbott and what to believe about what he says on this issue, of course, Greg Abbott was one of the first people to take to the podium at Uvalde and give us information that we turned out not to be true about what happened with the shooter at Robb Elementary. And you have you tweeted out recently that Greg Abbott was not lied to, Dan Patrick was not lied to, they knew exactly what happened, and they lied to us. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think I was shocked, just like every other Texan and Americans across the nation, that in the first week in particular, the version of events, the story about what happened, literally changed 3 or 4 times in a matter of a week. And folks like Greg Abbott and Dan Patrick were part of telling those falsehoods. They told false versions of events. And when it was revealed that the information they passed along to the public was not accurate, they claimed that they were lied to. So I posed the question, I've been posing the question, who lied to them? Because it wasn't just local police that were on the scene. You actually had federal, local, and state law enforcement officers who were present. And now it's been revealed that there were at least 13 DPS troopers who were inside the school, including in the hallway, while all of this was going on and while the shooter was holed up in a classroom and ultimately killed all the kids in the class. So is the governor saying, or the lieutenant governor, are they saying that they never talked to Steve McGraw, the head of DPS, and never talked to any of those DPS officers to get their account of what happened? Did the DPS director lie to them, or did the DPS officers who were there lie about what happened? There's been this effort to pass all of the blame to the school police chief and to the local law enforcement. And don't get me wrong, it's clear that they messed up. But, you know, you can't let our state officials basically come out with clean hands when there was also a lot of state law enforcement that was present. And it's also odd, you know, I want you to step back and think about the relationship between state government and local government in Texas. State government, as most folks know, Texas tends to usurp the power of local government in all sorts of things. And so it seemed very odd that when state troopers show up, they're better equipped, they're better armed than a local police chief, school police chief, or school police officers, that they would not have had more decision-making authority in what was going on. So basically these folks, the state of Texas, who usually usurp or take over control from local government, are now saying, well, actually, we were waiting on this school police chief, school district police chief, who's got a police force of probably five people to give us our instructions about what we were going to do. That seems very strange to me, given my understanding of how the state treats local governments and treats local school districts.
Joaquin Castro is a congressman representing San Antonio. The Democrat is pushing for what supporters call common sense gun laws. Summer officially starts on June 21st, but the heat wave isn't waiting. Already, Texans have been sweltering in record-breaking heat. They've been dealing with day after day of 100 degrees and record energy consumption. June started off with many wondering if the state's grid was up to the challenge. But Michael Weber, a UT Austin engineering professor and expert on energy, says not only is the grid holding, but renewable energy is keeping the lights on in Texas.
So far, so good. ERCOT looks good. It's got plenty of supply and reserves. And it might be that people have been good about adjusting thermostats and turning off demand as well. So all looks good, at least so far.
The grid has been breaking records with the amount of power generated and the amount that has been used. So maybe not so much conservation, but maybe the grid has gotten better.
There are a couple things going on. There might be some conservation, although I feel like, frankly, there's a long way to go on efficiency. We got a lot to do there. So it has been hot. Our air conditioners are on. The economy is bustling. So people are busy. Demand is up. And it's been really hot. Like, it's a really hot spring. And I've got to remind people, like, it's not even summer yet. And that heat drives a lot of demand for air conditioning, because in Texas, we have not invested enough in efficient homes and building standards and that kind of thing. So the demand goes up a lot when it's hot. But we also have built a lot of power plants in the last year and a half since that winter storm in February 2021. In particular, we built a lot of solar plants and a lot of batteries and some wind farms. And that new additional capacity, which is significant, is really performing well and really kind of keeping up with the demand so far. And the concern I have is what happens in August. It's this hot in June. Is it going to get hotter in August? But so far, the grid's looking good.
Well, also, I wonder about the wear and tear on the grid. These power plants need a lot of maintenance, typically. Even the wind farms, they need a lot of maintenance as well. And so is that something to be concerned about?
All of the power sector needs maintenance, the wires and poles, the substation, the transformers, but especially the power plants, and especially the thermal power plants. Those are the power plants that use heat to make power. That's like natural gas, coal, and nuclear power plants. They have a maintenance season that is in what we call the shoulder months, like the spring and the fall, when it's not too cold, not too hot. And that shoulder season is getting shorter and shorter because we have cold snaps that last deeper into the winter, and heat waves are starting earlier. We had a big heat wave in early May, for example. And so the maintenance season is getting shorter for those big thermal power plants, which means they have to hurry up to the maintenance, which means a lot of the power plants are kind of limping along through the hot season, which is already started and already upon us. And so we have a lot of outages, a lot more outages than we expect for this time of year. We normally expect like 4 gigawatts of thermal power plants to be out during the summer. And over the last 2 weeks, it's been like 6 to 7 gigawatts, so many more outages than we expect, and every gigawatt makes a difference. So that's primarily in natural gas and coal that we've had those outages. Wind and solar also need maintenance, but the difference is with a wind farm, if you have 100 turbines, you could do maintenance one turbine at a time. So when you do maintenance, you don't have to shut the whole thing down. Whereas at a natural gas power plant, you often turn the whole thing off to do maintenance, or a lot of it off. So there's a difference in the nature of the maintenance. They all need maintenance, but the thermal ones are really limping along. They're still bruised from winter 2021. And never really got their vacation to recover, and their maintenance season has been shorter.
It seems also that there was political pressure to keep all the power plants ready to rock. We've heard promises from Texas leadership that the lights would stay on, and that seemed to have come at the cost of powering down to do maintenance.
It seems like, without a doubt, there's a lot of pressure to keep everything on, which actually is a good thing. We want our politicians to care about the stability of the grid. So there's been a lot of pressure, but the pressure has been, especially on these thermal power plants, not to be down as much for maintenance. And there's also like some political identity stuff around this, that in Texas leadership eyes, renewables are bad and fossil fuels are good. So that's caught up in this as well, which is they really want the natural gas and coal plants to be performing. So they're manufacturer to do less maintenance, and ironically, that actually sets them up for bigger failure, because if you haven't done your maintenance, then you have more risks. So there's a lot of pressure from political leadership to keep the lights on, which means keep the power plants running, which means don't shut down for maintenance, which means the power plants might shut down because they need the maintenance.
Yeah, I'll just address that political identity issue of where our power comes from. We now know that Texas leads the nation in the generation of green energy. And for the first time in history, the United States has generated more electricity from renewable sources than from coal. That's according from new data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. And Texas leads the nation in renewable energy production. The renewables have basically carried a lot of this weight during the Texas heat wave. So to poo-poo green energy doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense.
It does not make sense to poo-poo green energy because we're so good at it in Texas, and it's making a lot of money for us, and it's saving a lot of money for consumers. It is cleaning up the air. It is generating tax revenues for these rural counties. It is a good story for Texas, and we should celebrate it and be proud of it.
So one thing about green energy, and we're dealing with a lot of inflationary pressures right now, okay? But it doesn't cost, the sun's not costing more to absorb those electrons, and the wind's not costing more to turn those propellers. So are we seeing inflationary pressures coming out of what we're getting from green energy?
So the inflation that we're experiencing with natural gas prices having doubled, the coal prices having doubled, this kind of thing, makes renewables look even better, because every megawatt hour we generate with a wind farm or a solar farm is a megawatt hour of electricity we don't have to buy from a gas plant or a coal plant. And so we save a lot of money on the fuel prices. And we're talking about many, many millions of dollars every single day in Texas during these heat waves. And over the course of the year, it'll be billions. So there's a lot of money that we're saving as consumers from this, which is really a great news story. It also means we have those fuels like natural gas that we can now export to other places like Europe to get them out from under the thumb of Russia. So it puts us in a position to be a better security ally for our friends across the ocean while also cleaning up our air and saving money here in the state.
So how much more would electricity be costing us right now if we didn't have renewables, if we were relying on, say, natural gas?
If we looked at today's prices for gas and coal and we didn't have all those renewables generating all the megawatt hours and electrons for us, it'd be many tens of millions of dollars, without a doubt, during this heat wave, and probably over $10 million a day.
So that's a lot of money. Households would feel that.
Oh, absolutely. Households are getting saved money. They don't know it yet as a startup of the bills, but our bills will be lower than they would have been if it had not been for the renewables.
So the price that the wind farms and the solar farms can charge for electricity, that's a floating price, and that is set by the natural gas price, right?
Yeah, so the wind farms and solar farms charge zero or even negative if it's a wind farm with a tax credit, but they're paid whatever price the natural gas power plants set the price at. So everyone in the power market's paid the same, but the price is set by natural gas. And so wind and solar, they're not asking to be paid that much. They're asking to be paid zero, but then they get paid more because of the way the auction clearing price works in the market.
So does that mean that people who have built these wind farms and solar farms, that they're seeing a windfall right now?
People who have built these wind farms and solar farms are getting paid a lot of money right now to save us money, which is great. So we all win. They win and we win.
What does that mean for the future of investment, the capital dollars that we need to build wind farms? And then after that, we'll talk about transmission.
I think it means there's going to be more money going into more power plants because people see that prices are high and they can undercut the high cost of gas and make a profit. So the high gas prices and high coal prices are going to incentivize more development of more power plants and more storage, and also puts pressure on the system to build more transmission lines to get those electrons from the generator to the market. So this will accelerate what's happening with the market trends.
And when you say power plants, you're not discriminating between thermal and renewable, right?
When their prices are high, that's a sign we need to build more power plants. But the kind of power plants we'll build will be the cheap ones, the wind and solar ones.
So transmission lines are still a problem. We have the highway to move all of that electricity that's generated by the propellers in the panhandle and getting them to the urban areas. That's congested, isn't it?
It's congested. In Texas, we're good at transmission lines and we're bad at transmission lines simultaneously. We had the CREZ lines, the Competitive Renewable Energy Zone lines. We spent $7 billion to build about a decade plus ago, and that really opened up the wind and solar resources in West Texas. But those lines are now full. We need to build some more again. And we're building some. There's approval for, I think, like $2.5 billion of transmission line expansion and upgrades. But we need to do a lot more quickly, like we've done in the past with building pipelines for oil and gas to help move the resource to market. We need to do the same thing with electrons.
Now, some people are saying we need more urban power generation, and that could either be with a rooftop solar, if that still makes sense for people. I don't know. And also, we're hearing from Elon Musk that he wants to do virtual power generation through tying together all of these Tesla batteries that they have, wall batteries that they have in people's homes. Is there a future for this virtual powered station that Elon Musk is trying to demonstrate?
Yeah, and just a quick comment on that. Virtual power plants, the idea of virtual power plants have been around for a long time. That's not Elon Musk's idea. He's a sort of latest entrant to that party, so to speak. The idea of using a bunch of small resources, which might be rooftop solar and batteries, tying them together to act in some organized, synchronized way to reduce total demand on the grid or to generate more power, that idea has been around for a while. And companies like Shell, the oil and gas company, has been active and made some announcements in this space as well. Makes perfect sense. It's growing. It will continue to grow. Rooftop solar helps people reduce their bills at home. Batteries help people improve their resilience. If you coordinate them, then we all benefit at the community level. And that really works well if you have an unshaded rooftop. But if you have like tree cover or if your rooftop's facing the wrong direction, it might not work at your home. But there's still a lot of sites in these cities to do that.
If we're getting so much of our power now from renewable sources, it's cheap, it's reliable. We're figuring out power storage in multiple different ways now. Why does it still have such a bad rap? Why do we still hear such negative energy coming from the right on renewables?
We're hearing such a bad rap from political leadership in Texas because for some reason the forms of energy have been adopted as part of political identity. And the political identity is such that fossil fuels are good according to Republicans and renewables are bad according to Republicans. And the Democrats will say the opposite, I guess. And it's just kind of strange to me. Frankly, they all have good and bad. They all have some performance benefits and some risks. But if you look at the Texas situation, the rhetoric is that renewables are bad and they're weak and they're liberal and they're communist or this kind of stuff that just makes no sense. When in fact, those renewables are saving us a lot of money and they're making us a lot of money. They're cleaning up the air and they're propping up the reliability of the grid. So I think it's time we update our simplistic view of these energy sources.
So we have this red versus blue mentality, but we're talking about something that is green. And when I say green, I don't mean renewable and hippy dippy. I mean like money green. Is that going to be the thing that really makes the difference?
That in the end, the last 15 years, it's been about making money from our land, which is a Texas thing. And so despite the rhetoric, wind and solar have really grown a lot. But what I worry is that the rhetoric will turn into policy actions that actually inhibit the growth of renewables by trying to put price adders on them or hit them with additional costs. That's been proposed by the governor's office, for example. So there are ways that the rhetoric gets into real inhibitions on development.
Michael Weber is a UT Austin engineering professor and an expert on energy. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.